This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
Thank you so much for coming. It's such a nice crowd. I wasn't expecting. I was like, maybe it would be like a really small room, two or three people at best. So of course, I'm going to focus a little bit on the prophethood, but what I really want to focus on a little bit is peppered throughout the way Muhammad was able to take advantage of geopolitical changes happening in and around Arabia. We'll talk a little bit about the allegations that have been made against him, and so how to make sense of all of that. Anyway, I have no idea what's going on with the... Who did it? Oh, it did? Oh. Oh, who's he? the unnamed one. All right. So basically, the idea is at this time, the Sasanian Empire, and multi-ethnic, to the northeast of Arabia, primarily Zoroastrian, and then you have the Byzantine Empire to the north and east, and they had been going at it for quite some time. Decades-long war, very weakened. So the Arabian tribes that were allied with either the Sasanians or the Byzantine empires, they were ready to shift allegiances. Right? So that's one of the things that Muhammad also ties into. The other thing to notice is the importance of, Western Arabia for its trade route. So Mecca becomes the city where Muhammad is born and then later conquers, driven out of and then conquers later, is also, of course, extremely important, a huge trade hub. So economically, very, very important. So these are a couple of big things that I guess we need to understand about the world that Muhammad was born into and grew up in. Okay, going back. Can I just use the thing over there? All right, anyway. So, very different though, right? Settled empires, right? Settled cultures, great civilizations versus a very nomadic pastoral people, right? So the Bedouin, the Arab nomads, so the Bedouin tribes, nomadic, pastoral, blood feuds because of their clan rivalries that would go on for generations on end. So that's a huge, huge part that we need to focus on. And of course, we already talked about the decline of neighboring powers is the, change that gives Bedouins really a lot of power. I mean, their clans become very dominant, a lot of them become rich with trade, so that's a big one too. Something interesting, though, this is still, Mecca is as cosmopolitan as I guess you can be in Arabia at the time. And, they have contact with great cultures. So Muslims look at all of pre-Islamic period and call it the period of ignorance. So Jahiliyyah, that's the period of ignorance or darkness. And that's how you have a break in history, ignorance and the message of God. Okay. Belief system, so that's another thing to focus on, that yes, primarily they are animists, and they have all sorts of different beliefs, pagan beliefs, they believe in magic, they believe in the jinn. We all know, right? We've probably seen movies or whatever about the jinn. So and these are powerful beings that need to be appeased somehow, right? Or can be controlled as well. So there are all these beliefs, but monotheism isn't something that's new to Arabia, right? So Muhammad wasn't coming up with something very novel. Yes, in some ways we can look at that. It's a slightly different message, but there are Jewish clans in Arabia, right? In Mecca, in Medina, right? There are large, very large Jewish clans. There are large Christian clans as well. So it's not just pagan tribes and pagan clans. There's definitely a decent size. I mean, I don't know the percentage-wise. It's still a minority, but you have clans that do quite well. The word for what they're called, the believers in just one God, but not any particular religion, monotheistic religion, is Hanif. And that's how Abraham was referred as a Hanif. So initially, when Muslims start out, they want to build a lineage, right, to ground themselves in that monotheistic tradition. And they say, well, we are the descendants of Abraham the Hanif, right, the monotheist. The only problem is that since the Christians, mainly Christians, but Jews also to an extent, they use this term very pejoratively. So, because like, what are you? You don't, who's this one God that you believe in, right? We have Adonai, we have Jesus. Like, so who is this you're talking about? And of course, they don't know the answer, right? They're like, we just believe in that there's a creator, that's it. We don't really have any kind of theological understanding or philosophical vision of the universe. So no heaven and hell issues going on. So later, Muslims actually will step away from using this and start describing Abraham as a Muslim. So he was the first Muslim in many ways, right? So not with the capital M, but the small M. So Islam is to surrender, literally. Islam is, means to surrender, and a Muslim is someone who has surrendered to the will of God, right? So it's particularly not surrender in general, but surrender to the will of God. So that's in that capacity, Abraham is supposed to be the first Muslim in some ways. Mecca, so the city where Muhammad is born. Quraysh tribe, which is Muhammad's tribe. You have larger tribes broken into smaller clans. So Quraysh are the people that come and conquer, actually, Mecca. It's a lucrative place, spice trade, right? All the incense and myrrh, that's it. They conquer Mecca, establish themselves. A century later, Muhammad is born. Really, it's had a good century to develop. Another interesting thing about Mecca is that it becomes a city for all the misfits, all the other places where the people are troublemakers and clans are like, no, you've been naughty, you're out of here. Mecca would give them refuge. Mecca, also home to the Kaaba, literally the cube. So no creative thought. just literally the cube, the Kaaba. Once again, Abraham is important in this tradition. It's said that this is where Adam and Eve actually, that this goes way back in the Muslim tradition. So Adam and Eve were planted, I guess, sent down into this area. They wandered, but then later Abraham, because of the holy nature of the site, builds a shrine to God. Who's the God? Abraham, right? Just Allah, and not Allah in the sense that we would think now. Allah was just a name for the Creator, right? That's how they're referred to. So anybody in the Arabic-speaking world at the time would, and there are reports of lots of actually Jews, Christians, right? All referred to God as Allah, like the universal Creator. If they were speaking of God in that sense, of course, if they were speaking of Jesus, and like particularly, it'd be different. But if they were just talking in a general sense, they would use the word Allah as well. So Kaaba, over time, this is of course like in the Muslim memory, really, right? That's the idea. But in all actuality, right, it is a polytheistic society, so lots of idols in the Kaaba. Mecca also, because of its economic nature and trade route importance, trade hub, it also becomes a site for pilgrimage and religious fairs. Another thing that's important on Mecca is one place. So there were blood feuds that would go on for generations, but in Mecca, if you were to come, you're just here to do business, right? You're here to trade, or you're here to for a pilgrimage, so no fighting is allowed, right? So there was like one place where they could have some sort of relative peace, really. So that's a little bit on Mecca. Right. I don't know what's happening. Is it a proximity thing? I'm testing it. I'm just going to go with it. Oh, get it. It's so much easier to just use this. pre-prophetic years, born in 570 CE, and to a Hashim clan, part of the Quraysh tribe that had conquered. His grandfather is one of the city elders. So he's part of the Quraysh tribe. He's one of the the representative from the Hashemite clan. By the way, I guess a quick trivia tidbit on it. The monarchy in Jordan are the descendants of the Hashemite clan, right? So that doesn't mean they're Muhammad's descendants, like literally, but they're that clan. So that's the idea. Anyway, Quraysh tribe, father, Abdullah. So Arabic names and lots of words, right, have this type of compounding. So you have, in this case, Abdullah, literally servant or slave of Allah. Right? So that's the idea. So that's also, tells us that the word Allah was being used quite commonly. People are naming people like that, right? Even before Islam, really. Right? So Abdullah is his father and dies before Muhammad is born. So Amina is pregnant with him. He dies before Muhammad is born. And Amina takes him to Medina to visit with family on the way back. So he's about 4 or 5 years old at the time, and she's coming back from Medina and gets sick. This is Medina is about 11 to 12 miles from Mecca, so a journey back in those days of a couple of hundred miles, it's not as easy as that. So it'd be like us driving from here to Dallas area suburbs, right? But back then, of course, it's dangerous still. She gets ill, she dies. He does have a nanny who used to be his wet nurse who then takes him, delivers him to his grandfather. A couple of years, grandfather takes care of him, dies. His uncle then takes custody of Muhammad. So the importance of this part of the story is that the way Muhammad focused on taking care of orphans, right, because he was an orphan himself, is actually quite interesting to see, because in this society, right, women don't have any protections. Orphans don't have protections. Any marginalized population really doesn't have any legal protection of any kind. So orphans is also, the orphans are just also one of the communities because he was an orphan. So uncle wasn't that wealthy. He would earn his keep by becoming a shepherd and like take people's goats around and help raise them. But he did eventually, once he's a teenager, he starts going on trading trips. So his uncle is a trader. He goes as far as even Syria. And so this is where Muhammad is coming into contact. He's a curious, inquisitive person. It is said that he is also troubled by idol worship and all the things he sees. I mean, like I said, he's seen how orphans are treated, right? And being an orphan himself to an extent, right? He's definitely troubled by what the society has maybe become even in his lifetime, if it's deteriorating, but definitely what he's seeing, it's problematic to him. So anyway, so he on his travels, and especially in Syria, it said he meets a Coptic priest who just actually recognized him. So he's in the marketplace with his uncle. The Coptic priest sees this young boy, and he just recognizes him. Like, this is like God's inspiration or something, like inspired by God. Like, okay, I recognize you. He asked Muhammad to show him a birthmark, like on his shoulder or something. And he said, okay, yeah, now I have proof that you are a prophet. But it said that he also warns his uncle to, because there are powerful Jewish clans in Mecca, Medina, all over. So he's like, yeah, you know, just don't tell the Jews because he will not be safe. So that's the tradition. It was like saying, like, the Jews will kill him, actually. So it's interesting that these stories, how they're formed. How true it is, of course, right? We don't know. But that's the Muslim memory, really. Okay. So yeah, trader. He does, though, right, establish this reputation for himself, and that he's a trustworthy person. He's honest. He doesn't cheat you, which actually helps him land his first wife. So Khadija is actually an older, his like. 15 years his senior, he's 25, she's almost 40 at the time when they get married. She tests him, actually. she has been widowed 2-3 times, and she's had some inherited some wealth and a trading business from at least one of her previous husbands. And so she wants somebody who can help her with it. And she hires him, sends him on a little trading trip, and she sees how fairly he's treated her. Like, he hasn't tried to finagle anything, any more money or anything out of her, or say, oh, I lost some cargo back then. I mean, imagine going to mechanics these days, right? Like, my female friends are like, oh, come with me so that they don't try to cheat me. Like, I don't know anything about cars, but I'll go with you anyway. So that's the idea, basically. So he is, and actually she ends up, this is also very much a break from tradition. She is so taken by him and his character that she proposes to him. Like, and yeah, so they get married, and throughout her life, he never takes another wife. After that, he has multiple wives. But as long as Khadija is alive, he doesn't marry anybody else. So true love, perhaps, right? And she's a benefactor, but she's a supporter. So you'll see, he is a spiritual seeker, does often step away, right? Takes himself out of this huge, bustling, not huge, but a bustling town for that region, really, right? Goes into the wilderness and spends a lot of time. It said that he goes for days at a time. Right? Several days he can spend in a cave just meditating and just contemplating. And that's where the revelation of the Quran comes in. Khadija, the first convert to Islam. So she believes in him when he comes to her with the message. Anyway, so Mount Hira, in Mount Hira, Archangel Gabriel, or Jibrail in Arabic, he comes. He doesn't know, of course, Muhammad doesn't know, when he just sees this beautiful, right, vision, and finds out it's Gabriel, and he tells him, and this is kind of interesting. He just tells him a word. He said "ikra," so it can be like either read or recite. More likely recite, and grabs him, says, embraces him tightly, and transfer knowledge into Muhammad. The first revelation, not like all knowledge of the universe, it's like the first revelation, the message that he needs to take to people. He's 40 at the time, 610 CE, and he's troubled by this. So he does not just go and tell people, right? I mean, he's very troubled. Like, what is this that I just experienced? Khadija is the one. So the story goes, he goes and he just falls in her lap, and with his head in her lap, and he's trembling, and he's just drenched in sweat with what just happened. And she comforts him and asks him to tell her, right? Explain to her what happened. Why is he? She's never seen him like this. So he tells her what happened, and she believes him. Right? She's not like, oh, you're out of your mind, go back to work or something. Right? It's like, I mean, she believes him and in his mission. And so 3 years, right? 3 years, he is only... So he's getting revelations, right? Periodically. He's getting revelations. These are the Mecca years. So... the Quran can't be really divided into any kind of specific themes chronologically. It's all over the place. But some of the things that scholars have tried to do is do the Mecca year revelations, which focus very much so on the Day of Judgment, right? Repenting for your sins. So it has nothing to do with the politics of the community. So all the statescraft, what makes him a statesman, comes in the Medina years, and the revelations that come during the Medina years have a lot of those types of themes that focus on the law. And of course, somewhat problematic, this is where also Christians and Jews are made to, you're supposed to question like that, and they also say that Christians and Jews have lost their way, and Islam is correcting that, righting the wrong. They have distorted the Bible, some of those types of things. He's able to convert close family members. Not his uncle, though, but his uncle still supports him, right? 613, he's starting to preach publicly. Meccans are not happy about it, right? I mean, it's economically, it's not a very good thing for them, right? Like so many people come from all over Arabia to worship all these idols in the Kaaba. So we're a city of many gods, right? And like, what are you here preaching one god? This is not good for business, right? So his one regret, really, wasn't able to convert his uncle, perhaps a regret. But his uncle does support him. His uncle does support him, protects him. After his uncle dies, that's when the Meccan clans can really go after him, and they plot against him. There are several failed attempts to kill him, which also then force Muhammad and his community out of Medina. So he's proclaiming that Allah was the one true God. Persecution took on a lot of different forms. The biggest thing is don't sell food to, don't do business with them, don't sell any food to these people, right? Maybe deny access to your wells if they are around. These are necessities, really, right? Of course, denouncing them as a soothsayer. They believed in magic anyway, so it's maybe he's hypnotizing people, he's finding these converts, right? Those types of things. Of course, they don't have a philosophical vision of the universe, so they definitely don't understand what's this concept of resurrection and day of judgment and all of those things. But they, of course, have been exposed, right, to Judaism and Christianity, so they know, right? Moses had his miracles, right? Raising his staff and letting the battle be won, right? Jesus had his miracles. He cured people. Where's your miracle, right? And that's what they're asking. If God has chosen you, where are your miracles? And he responds, well, my miracle is the Quran, right? Why is that kind of a miracle? Because it's said that Muhammad is illiterate. And so there's no way he can, or anybody, they can compose this very beautiful, all these beautiful verses of the Quran. So that he says, that's my miracle. Something interesting on that, though, so if we go to much later in history, during the colonial period, European colonization of Muslim lands, so we're talking 1700s, 1800s, there's definitely this movement, right, to whether it's in India and everything, it's not really that much conversion. There are missions, but the project is not about conversion. But there is definitely a concerted effort to have Christianity take the moral ground. So whether it's saying, oh, how immoral, four wives you have, Muslims or Hindus, the sati, the widow immolation, right? This is just ridiculous, so barbaric. So there's definitely that kind of comparison of religions and saying that no, Christianity is better because we don't do, of course, never mind all the political advancements and whatnot that led to, I guess, women having protections and whatnot. So Muslims in response, if you talk to people in South Asia, they will actually, so they came up with stories to attribute miracles to Muhammad. So at this time, so now suddenly you have India is India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, South Asia is the largest Muslim population area, and yeah, they have lots of stories on Muhammad healing the sick also, just like Jesus. The biggest one is when the Meccans asked him for a miracle, Muhammad looked at the moon and split it in two and then put it back together. And we have proof because this Raja in India wrote about it in his journal. He said, one night I was just out there and I saw the moon being split and being put back together. I don't know what the time difference is between the two, but I guess the moon was quite clearly visible both places at the time. So he was 63 when he died. So lots of persecution, no converts. Am I okay on time? Yeah, I'm okay on time. All right. So no converts because of this reason, and they are very much secluded, and life is becoming more and more difficult. Medina is an important. Once again, I think events were just conspiring, perhaps, right, to work out in favor of Muhammad. Or, I mean, he's just taking advantage of them. So he's able to see. So he's like, he isn't somebody who has a grand master plan, but he did have the ability to see what the events were on the ground and the geopolitical realities and respond to them very, very effectively. So Medina, clan rivalry, it's out of control. And a huge tradition in the Bedouin culture was to bring a trusted third party to come and mediate. Right? If you're having a dispute and it's gotten out of hand, surely we can't solve it through killing each other, because I mean, we've been doing it for ages now. So let's have somebody we can both trust. And Muhammad, right, through his travels and interactions with people, he has established that reputation for himself. Right? And he's known as Al-Amin, the truthful or the trustworthy one. So it just works out so well for him. They invite him. They say, we need your help. He agrees, but on the condition that they will one, accept him as the messenger of God and convert to Islam. And they're like, okay, we'll do it. The pagan tribes. There are three big clans, Jewish clans in Medina. Of course, they will not convert, right? So, and at the, in the beginning, of course, right, Muhammad's fine with, I mean, Islam, even to this day, actually says that, yeah, people of the book, Ahl al-Kitab, so the people of the book, Jews and Christians, they are to be respected, right? Their traditions, reality, of course, can be different in many ways, too, sometimes, on every side, really, right? So they did accept Quranic revelations, becoming Muslim, did accept him as the messenger of God. All of them signed the Pledge of Aqaba for a mutual defense pact that if anybody else, Meccans or whoever, because Muhammad has enemies, Meccans are his enemies, and so that all of them will come and support. The Jews, of course, don't convert, but they do also sign the pledge. Two clans, Jewish clans, are exiled within the first few years, and the reason being that Muhammad is trying to create a community, right? He's trying to create a community, and they are really undermining his mission, right? So this is also often used in one of the allegations against him is that he was just out for personal ambition, and but the decisions, every time he made different decisions, it shows that it was for community, really, rather than anything else. So that's one of the things. So what they were doing was they were picking out mistakes. So Muhammad, in Islamic tradition, it's not Isaac, it's Ishmael that Abraham is supposed to sacrifice, right? And they're like that's not right, come on. So that must not be the right message from God. And so Muhammad's response is, no, you guys are the one who've distorted and lost the proper teachings. This is the right history, right? He also, of course, knowing his history, he tells all the people that, hey, you know, well, yeah, of course Jews are rejecting me because Jews have rejected so many prophets that God has sent him. So, of course, they're going to reject me too. Like, what do you expect? Right? So he's, I mean, he has to kind of like, try that. But this is the biggest danger to him when he's trying to create a community in the beginning, that that all these people are like trying to say he's an imposter, like this isn't correct. So he's trying to fight against that. So the first thing is that, okay, these people are becoming too problematic, so we have to exile him. The second is The third clan, the second, retaliation against Jewish clans, this was a more drastic one. Based off of, so the Meccans come, it's called the Battle of the Trenches, Muslim forces and their allies, they dig trenches to make the Meccan cavalry ineffective, basically, and the Meccans don't want to really engage in infantry, close combat like that, because they had seen in many battles, even though the Meccans had outnumbered, Muhammad's forces were often triumphant. And I guess the reason being, they were fighting for their survival, really, right? So they did fight with, more vigor and all that stuff, because Meccans, when they would come, their allies were just there for booty, really, right? They didn't really care one way or another. But for these people, it was a matter of survival, right? So, of course, they're going to fight with a lot more, but of course Muslims say that, well, it was because God was on their side, and I guess that's in every tradition. Every tradition says we won because God was on our side. So, one of the Jewish clans they have signed the pledge, and they also help in material ways, right? So giving tools to prepare for the siege and everything, but they're not committing forces to fight, which is fine, right? I mean, the pledge doesn't say how you're going to help. It's just you have to help, right? You have to, it's a mutual defense pact. So they do help, but the Meccans do try to win this clan over. And so they start negotiating with the Meccans that maybe we'll switch sides and actually aid you in taking over Medina. Muhammad gets word of that, and he actually sends people very clever maneuver, and somebody who's trusted in the Meccan camp, because remember, a lot of these are former Meccans, and so he sends a couple of people to spread the word in the Meccan camp that, oh, by the way, you know what? The Jewish clan is going to, in order to switch sides, they're going to ask you for some senior hostages, and but they're actually going to turn them over to Muhammad. And, of course, that was the tradition, so when the negotiations are being finalized, the Jewish clan does ask for hostages as a guarantee that you're not going to abandon us, right, if we switch sides. And so they're like, oh, yeah, so, but we've already heard that you're going to turn them over to Muhammad, so no deal, right? The weather also works in favor of the Muslim forces. It's exceptionally cold and windy, and the Meccan forces, their tents are blown off and everything. So after several days of siege, Meccans are like, okay, we're leaving. Before Muslims start celebrating, Muhammad's like, no, we're not done. And he goes, and so the Jewish clan has their stronghold, and he goes and puts the Jewish clan stronghold under siege. 25 days they negotiate back and forth, and finally the leader of the clan tells the people, okay, we have a couple of options. We kill all the women and children and we go fight and see what happens, because we're definitely outnumbered, we're not going to survive. Muhammad, of course, wants them to unconditionally surrender, because they were asking for terms that, remember, you let the other two clans go into exile, like treat us the same way, and he's not having it. He does, however, and this is also a very interesting, statescraft, really, right? He doesn't want to make the decision himself. And this is also because of clan alliances and whatnot. So he allows for one of the allies of this Jewish clan, but somebody who had converted to Islam. So it has to be a Muslim, but it can be one of your allies. So this person comes and renders his judgment. He says the men are to be executed and women and children are to be sold into slavery. And it's said that, I mean, this guy had been wounded in this Battle of the Trenches kind of time, so, and he was old, and so he wasn't really thinking that much about his alliance, and how, like, he cared for the Jewish clan, right? He was allied with them, but he was thinking more about, hey, I got to go answer to God, so I'm going to make a decision based on that, that did I protect the Muslim, the nascent Muslim community or not, right? So... So about 600 to 700 men are beheaded, and women and children are sold into slavery. The other two clans, one of the clans actually, I think, leader of the clan, does buy several, I don't know how many, but I said there were about, so there are 600 or 700 men in the clan, about 800-900 women, and children, and that they do buy them from Muslims to free them, but several of them, of course, are sold into slavery.
All the camels.
Oh, why is this?
This camel.
Oh yeah. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Be seen as anti-Semitism per se. But I've got nothing against the Jewish people per se, or the Jewish religion. The Quran continues to tell Muslims to honor the people of the book and to honor their religion as authentic.
It's unfortunate that many historians, and particularly in contemporary times, both on the Jewish and on the Muslim side, have transformed this. On the Jewish side, they have used that as a way of saying, where you see Muslims hate the Jews and they kill them. And on the Muslim side, it says, where you see the Jews are full of treachery and can't be trusted. Both are wrong.
All right. So, another interesting thing, Hijra, the migration from Mecca to Medina, another move that's, I think, a testament to his statescraft. So, it's not the revelation that marks the beginning of the Muslim calendar, but rather the beginning of the community, right? So, emphasis once again is community. So, in Medina, that's where the first Muslim community emerges, and that's where the emphasis is. While in Medina, initially Jerusalem is the direction of the prayer, the Qibla, and this is also not historically proven, but it did happen, the changing of the direction, but the story goes in Muslim memory that they were actually praying at the time. And Muhammad gets a revelation that tells him to change direction from Jerusalem to Mecca. And so everybody just turns around and said, in actuality, it probably happened over a period of time, not while they were in the middle of the prayers. Once again, his eyes are on Mecca. He understands the importance of Mecca and making Mecca... the Qibla, the direction of the prayer. Well, you certainly can't pray towards the Kaaba that has all these idols. We have to take it, right? So that makes it very important to now conquer Mecca. And by this time, more and more tribes, with every victory that they have, Muhammad attracts more and more Bedouin tribes to his cause. A lot of them are actually... initially interested in really, okay, he's winning, we'll be able to plunder a lot if we're with him. Right? So eventually, many convert also, but that's also an ongoing process. It's not like suddenly everybody's converted and whatnot. First thing that he does, so Mecca is taken actually without fighting. I mean, it's a huge force that's coming, and they have people in the front that are announcing that if you go and don't fight, you won't be harmed. And he lives up to his word. In fact, one of the leaders in Mecca who hated Muhammad and had to try to have him killed, he actually announces that his house is going to be a safe space. So if you can just get to his house also, you are absolutely in no danger at all. So to show him that he's also safe. Performs a last pilgrimage in 632 in Mecca, and then comes back to Medina and dies shortly afterwards. Of course, the legacy, I think he did unite these very much fragmented society, I mean, that were at each other's throats for centuries. So the Muslim Ummah, the community, like, that's always his focus. In fact, once they are strong enough in Medina, and as soon as they take Mecca, he starts sending emissaries and also fighters to go start fighting against any tribes in the north that were allied to Sasanians or the Byzantines, and to have them come over to his side as well. And the idea was to keep all the young hot bloods out of Mecca and Medina. Go out, go fight. we have to build a community here. So all you people who are going to be interested in like all the plundering and everything, you don't need to be sticking around. Why don't you all go somewhere else? Did the Pope do that back in the Crusade time? Like, all you knights, go fight somewhere. Don't, you're making a mess in Europe. So maybe he learned that from Muhammad. Who knows, right? So, all right. In his time, he's definitely a reformer, right? So giving women didn't have any rights of divorce or a marriage contract, right? Judaism has a tradition of the marriage contract. So that's what he starts too. So now finally women have certain rights in marriage, and they can get divorced. Children, even girls, albeit less, half the inheritance, but they have inheritance, right? Girls, women didn't have any of that. So at his time, he is definitely a reformer. Children, the elderly, orphans, like we said, he was definitely very partial towards them, sympathetic to their plight, brought political authority in order. I mean, these clans would shift allegiances left and right, depending on who's strong at what time. And he brought them into like one community and leadership. The other big thing is, so not only was he able to react to these events effectively, the people that he chose and put in positions of leadership, so these are the first four caliphs, so that's a story for another time, but these were people that, I mean, that were effective leaders. So, I mean, I guess a quality in a leader is, right? Like, who do you delegate? Who do you choose? How do you choose people? So, right? So he literally had the best people, the best. Oh my God. Anyway, little political humor. Sorry, that just went dead. I have the best people. He literally did, yes.
What is that a breakdown of?
Oh, just a little, like what it is now. I should have mentioned. So, I mean, his legacy, right? Like compared to, it is the fastest growing religion, second largest in the world. Of course, there are breakdowns in Muslims and Christians and all this.
That's the whole world.
That's the whole world, yeah, yeah. So, and I picked this one. I know, I'm sorry. I kind of picked this one, it's a stock one, but it actually shows like a little sliver for Jews in there. A lot of them don't because it's hardly visible. So there are a lot of these allegations, right? He's an imposter, he's treacherous, he's lustful, all of these things. So we just have to, I guess, like try to, from learning about his history, see, I mean, the whole thing about, though, he married young girls, well, 700-800 years later, or it was still happening in Europe. I mean, especially in nobility, older men, especially if they're like inheritance was concerned, they're marrying young girls. So like these types of things are always leveled against him. Imposter, right? Ambitious for himself. Those are some of the things that are said. So yeah, I think I'm out of time, right? Yeah. So anyway, the idea is that no, in his time, nobody thought of him as an imposter or treacherous once they agreed with his message, and actually they thought he was a moral and upright person and a reformer. All right, that's it. We are done. The talk. Thank you. Thank you so much.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.